and on the web at double.
There's no crime in giving yourself over to pleasure.
Yeah. a bird at your door.
Hello, everyone. It is Mitch Saunders once again, 10 a.m., starting a little bit late today, but you're listening to Swing Politics with Big Mitch. It is a really interesting day. I'm a little bit tired, excuse me, but there's been some interesting results that have come out of presidential primaries the past few weeks, or the past few days. I know that last week we spoke about U.S. Senate primaries, and today we are going to be discussing presidential primaries, which is top of the ticket, most important election, and these very uncompetitive primaries have some very interesting nuances going on with them this cycle as we have two effectively de facto incumbents, one real incumbent, one de facto incumbent, as both the presumptive nominees for their respective parties. I guess let's get started with the most recent primary result that seemed to be in a lot of discussion to try to read the tea leaves of what's been going on in the primary, in Trump's popularity, etc. And that primary was in South Carolina. The Democratic primary for South Carolina was about a week ago, but the Republicans just held theirs on this past Saturday. And the election results showed Trump winning 60% of the vote, just about, to former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley's vote share, which was about 40%. They were both a little bit under 60 and a little bit under 40%. Now, it's unclear sort of how this will shake out in terms of the strength, because obviously Trump is the nominee for the Republican this cycle. It's unclear exactly how this performance cuts into an argument for his strengths or against his strengths. Now, I guess on the side of sort of was this a good night for Trump getting 60% of the vote, he really didn't spend a whole lot of time in South Carolina. He didn't really do very many campaign events. He was quickly endorsed by all of the leading partisan Republican office holders in the state. The governor, Henry McMaster, endorsed him well before Iowa. Tim Scott endorsed him shortly after he dropped out. Tim Scott is the junior senator from the state. Lindsey Graham has also endorsed him, one of his sort of little pawns in whatever game, you know, Trump likes to play for his own benefit. They've all endorsed him really quickly. Most of the South Carolina Republican congressional delegation has done so. So it was, you know, that the fact that Trump had so much support there will be one of his, I guess, weaknesses, but not a particularly strong one. What I'll talk about first is the fact that he didn't spend a lot of time there, and he didn't spend a lot of money there. He really didn't spend anything on advertisements. In total, he spent about $1.2 million, which is a drop in the bucket compared to what will be spent in the general election and in, you know, really so many of these competitive House and Senate primaries today. In the Tom Suozzi, Mozzie Pillup New York 3 special election just, I think, 2 weeks ago now, they spent around $22 million in total. And in 2017, in Georgia's 6th Congressional District, in the Karen Handel versus John Ossoff, yes, that John Ossoff for that special House election, it was the most competitive, I believe the most competitive House race ever run, with $50 million being spent on it. So $1.2 million for a presidential nominee is nothing, but he didn't really need to spend any money there because he felt he was going to win it commandingly. And he did, but again, the nuances here are important. But he didn't spend a lot of time, didn't spend a lot of money. Haley spent a lot of time and a lot of money. And not to mention, she was the governor of the state for 6 years. She worked at the state level before then she became governor and then went on to be Trump's Trump's UN ambassador. The fact that she represented the state for so long and still only amassed 40% is sort of a good sign, at least speaks to the lack of sort of pull that Haley might have with a constituency that's known her for so long. Or it might just say, hey, you know, they like Haley and they know Haley, but they like Trump even more. And I think that, weirdly enough, an argument for Trump's strengths is that Haley voters were motivated to turn out. Haley voters are tend to be based on what the Iowa, New Hampshire, and mostly the New Hampshire election results for the primary so far have shown us, is that Haley is winning with independents and moderates, She is whatever sect of Democrats are voting in these open primaries, which was about 4% of Democrats that voted in the Republican primary. They're voting for her en masse. And she has, you know, the educated suburban, what I like to call Romney Republican sect of the party, which is a dying breed. It's almost the Tea Party Republicans. And these educated suburban Republican, you know, ancestral Republicans essentially are what I talk about so frequently as lockstep Democratic voters. Now, they voted for Romney in 2012, and the idea of voting for a Republican, for a MAGA Trump Republican in 2024, is nauseating to them. And they hate the idea, of course, of a Biden-Trump rematch, but they'll never vote for Trump. Whether or not they'll vote for Biden is a different story. But these voters are disproportionately heard in off-year elections. So in total, college-educated voters in the South Carolina primary made up 43% of the total primary vote, which is a really high number. South Carolina is, I believe, just under the average in terms of its college-educated vote. Let's find out. The college, it is 30%. 30% of South Carolina has a bachelor's degree, which means that, you know, 30% of the population do, but 43% of the voting population in this primary were college educated or post-college educated, post-grads. So the fact that they have an outsized role will inherently support Haley. And because Trump voters are unaware of the elections going on. Trump voters are generally not primary voters. They're not off-year election voters. They really don't know that if Trump is running, that Trump really has an opponent. And they don't really feel a need to go out and vote. Whereas Haley voters are essentially, in some respects, Biden voters. Many Haley voters will vote for Biden in 2024. In terms of how the vote breakdown went, Trump won non-college educated voters at 72%. He won like 72% of them, and Haley won like 25%, something like that. And for the college educated voters, they were nearly split. I would have anticipated that Haley would have done a little bit better with college educated voters in the state. And the fact that one of every two voters that are college educated is voting for Haley is a really bad sign for Trump's campaign, in my mind, at least. Obviously, not all of these voters will vote for Biden. Not one out of every two college educated Republican is going to vote for Biden, but one out of every two really does not feel like they want to vote for Trump. And in addition to that, there was an interesting thing that the exit polls demonstrated, that one out of every five GOP voter in this primary will not vote for Trump. One in five GOP voters will not vote for Trump. And I was just listening to a Pod Save America podcast, and these were people that worked on the Obama 2008 and 2012 campaigns. And really interesting statistic that I can't remember his name, but the person who they run the podcast, and what they found was that in 2008, after Clinton dropped out and endorsed Obama, that 53% of Clinton supporters would vote for Obama, whereas 47% said that they would not. That's basically one in every two voters. So, you know, to say that, you know, it's easy for one in five GOP voters to say right now that, you know, they won't vote for Trump. But, you know, when November comes around and they see all the party members that are endorsing, and they finally see McConnell and Chris Sununu and Larry Hogan and all these, you know, well-respected quote-unquote moderates in the party that have endorsed Trump, that are endorsing Trump, they'll come around and they'll be, yeah, I really don't like him, but, you know, all of my guys are going to vote for him, so why don't I? And there, you know, the caveat to this is that Obama was not a well-defined candidate to the national general election populace until, you know, maybe October of 2008. And also the financial crisis really unified the Democratic Party at the time. But Trump is a well-defined character. If you know him, you know him, and you generally like him. I mean, Trump hasn't been on the ballot since before January 6th, which I think changed a lot of minds in terms of college-educated voters, and that's the reason why you're seeing a lot of Nikki Haley support. But the, you know, in terms of getting back to the main point here, Haley's voters were voters that were going to turn out anyway. They're always going to vote. That's their hallmark. That's why Democrats do well in off-year elections in the you know, Trump and Biden era, and that's why Republicans did really well in off-year elections in the Obama era. Because the coalitions, the party coalitions, were inherently very different. But now the Democrats have taken on those high-propensity voters, and Republicans have consistently shedded them and continue to. So, with that in mind, 60% with Trump's electorate seems pretty impressive. Or maybe not impressive, but it seems strong. Under a normal, maybe, election circumstance, you'd have 70-30, or you'd have maybe even 80-20, if you were to take a poll of Republicans. But that being said, on the other hand, speaking of the polls, Haley outperformed the polls by around 8%. And from what I've understood based on a New York Times article that I read, it's that they really don't ask about any Democrats, and they really don't, they don't interview Democrats who are voting in the Republican primary. South Carolina has an open primary. But Haley outperformed the polls, and this is sort of a consistent thing that's been going on, with Haley outperforming the polls compared to Trump in New Hampshire and not in Iowa, but because Iowa's caucus system, so it's not really something you can take into account. But the fact that Trump has underperformed in two standard open primaries, I believe New Hampshire is open, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember. I believe it is. Yes, it is. What does that say about general election polling? They've been about 8% off in favor of Haley. Haley won about 44%, 43% in New Hampshire, I think, and or around 40%. And she also won the same amount in South Carolina, and she overperformed the polls by high single digits numbers. Does this mean that Biden's polling is sort of not accounting for shy non-Trump voters and shy Biden voters and voters who are not really excited about Trump and they really want to vote for anyone but Trump, but they really don't want to say that in the polls? Is it not registering? Is that possible? That could be the case for the general election? Maybe. We don't really know yet. It's not really very concrete. And the fact that Haley is outperforming polls is not necessarily a great sign for the Trump campaign. Also, the fact that Haley is winning moderates and independents. Now, the Electoral College obviously has a skew that helps Republicans, but in every presidential election going back to, I think like the 70s or 80s, the candidate that has won independent voters has won the presidency. In 2016, Trump actually won independence by 1 point. Trump was in 2016 perceived as a moderate amongst the field. This was a field of Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, John Kasich. He was somewhere in the middle. He wasn't necessarily as moderate as John Kasich, but he was seen as more moderate on abortion. And he was not really supported by the hard right. You know, the far right was more Ted Cruz and even Marco Rubio to some extent. And because of that, he was able to win the Electoral College because he maintained that moderate image in 2016. In 2024, Trump's not getting any moderate image, especially when he's talking about, jailing up his political enemies, making sure that schools are dictated at the federal level, local curricula are dictated at the federal level, pulling out of NATO, making sure Russia wins the war against Ukraine. I mean, these are not things of a moderate ideology. This is, the makings of a dictator. And if Trump was just a little bit more politically expedient and understanding of the situation, he would be a truly, truly dangerous threat. So Republicans got a little bit unlucky with who they, hitched their wagon to. But it's not their party anymore. Their Republican mainstay, at least. It's not their party. It's the autocrat, demagogue, rhetoric party of propaganda, which has been building for 30 years now, but the point remains true. But regardless, Haley won independence, is winning independence and moderates. That's the case in New Hampshire. That was the case in South Carolina on Saturday night. So there's something that this rings similar to, which is in 2016 in the Democratic primary. In the Democratic primary, it was a little bit similar to the dynamics of Trump and Haley. Clinton was considered, effectively a de facto presumptive nominee. No one was really challenging her. And Bernie Sanders kind of came in and pushed the party more to the left. Now, it's a different case of Haley trying to bring the party a little bit more centrist, even though she's barely more moderate than Trump. But Trump's the more extreme one compared to Clinton, who was the more moderate one. But the fact that you really did have Sanders winning independents and moderates. Sanders won many of these primary states against Clinton in 2016, in many of the cases, a lot of the independent moderate, either by plurality or by majority percentage of that vote. Percentage of that group. And that, that was something that everyone sort of brushed off and didn't really pay much attention to, also because I think the dynamics of primaries have not really been analyzed quite in the way that they're being analyzed today. But this was, in retrospect, a major warning sign that Clinton was not appealing to the people that she needed to deliver her the presidency. The Democratic base in 2016 turned out really, really heavily for Clinton. More so, maybe a little bit less than, I believe, Obama in 2012. But more so than it had in even 2008, weirdly enough. In 2008, only 89% of Democrats voted for Obama. And I believe different realignment stuffs. But the main point is that Clinton was not getting a wide enough tent. She was not bringing in Democrats and independents, which is what you need to win in these primaries. Yet, that's the same thing that Trump is unable to do this cycle. So far in these primaries, two primaries, he has not found a way. He has not discovered a way to win independents like he did in 2016. That's because he's not moderate, he's not independent. But shouldn't that raise warning signs? Just like Clinton in 2016, Trump in 2024 is a very, 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 very well-known character. Equal to Biden. So if he's consistently losing independence to an insurgent, more moderate, relatively candidate, and two out of the five voters that go to the polls really don't want him, and those voters are independents, what does that say for his general election odds? To be fair, there's not a whole lot of correlation between primary performance and general election performance in this stuff. There's a lot of statistical noise. And those 1 in 5 GOP voters that say they will not vote for Trump. If Trump lost 20% of the Republican base, it would be an absolute landslide. And you can bet that's not going to happen. I think that the other warning sign is the fact of the college-educated voters, that one in two college-educated voters did not want to vote for Trump. These are the voters that turn out. In a presidential election, I understand that there's going to be sort of a less prevalent, a less weighted college-educated group that will have a sway over the polls. That'll have a sway over the election results. But that being said, consistently, college-educated voters are a greater percentage of the voting population than they are of the national population because of their consistent turnout and their awareness of what is going on in the political world in terms of when they have to vote. So in my mind, if I were to take this primary and say who won or who lost, I would say that there's a major asterisk next to this because, again, primary results are not indicative of general election results. And there's a lot of weird information going on. There's a lot of differing thoughts that are sort of ping-ponging. But I would say that Trump lost and Haley didn't win. Trump not spending time here and not spending money here doesn't really matter because he is the nominee. Whether he spent a ton of money or he spent no money, I don't think it would have changed the result. Maybe it would have had his base turn out a little bit more, which might have cushioned his margin. But I don't think that really would have made quite the difference if he had spent more time and rallied and all that stuff. I think he also wanted to prove that, like, no, I can win by a big margin without even trying. But the way that Trump lost was because there's some small warning signs of the fact that he hasn't consolidated the Republican base. We will see after Election Day, after Super Tuesday. I mean, South Carolina came in 2020, and it was over for the Democratic primary. It was Biden's. It was Biden's to lose, and he didn't lose. He didn't lose that primary when Super Tuesday rolled around, because we've got Super Tuesday coming up in, I believe, a week. And we're going to see just how much resistance there is in the Haley wing. And we're also going to see that tonight because there is a Michigan primary tonight for the presidency, and it is a closed primary, which is really, really different from the other two that we've had so far. So only registered Democrats can vote in the Democratic primary, and only Republicans can vote in the Republican primary. So while we're on the topic of the Republicans, I'm going to focus on them for now and then switch to the interesting stuff going on the Biden Democratic primary side for Michigan. So Haley's been campaigning in Michigan since Saturday, doing a lot of events. I don't know if Trump has really been doing many events, but personally, it doesn't seem like he has. It's definitely been more of a ground game by Haley in Michigan. But the fact that it's a closed primary will tell us exactly what we're dealing with. So independents can't vote in this, and there is a time frame before the primary that you have to change your party affiliation. So you can't just walk into the ballot box and say, I'm polling place and say, I'm a Democrat, but I'm going to register as a Republican. Can I vote? No, there's a few weeks that this needs to be done. There's a deadline by which you need to change your party registration in order to vote in that primary. So on the Republican side, we're going to see how much of the Republican base does Trump really have? And how much does Haley have? You'll see the same sort of setup that you did in New Hampshire and in South Carolina, that you'll have cities and suburban areas that are going to be for Haley by a bit, not a huge margin, but by a bit, and you're going to have the rurals that are going to blow out for Trump. Funny enough, if you were to repeat that in a general election, you're going to have Biden winning the suburbs and the urban areas, and you're gonna have Trump again blowing it out in the rural areas. But there's no one-to-one comparison for that. In terms of polling, we've got Trump sitting at around, we've got Trump sitting around 70% more. Trump is at 80%, just about 80%, 79% to Haley's 22%, 78% to Haley's 22%. I wonder how this is going to shake out. I don't know entirely what each data point will mean. I don't know if this really tells us anything for the general election. The only thing this tells us about is Trump's base and who is motivated to turn out and who is aware to turn out. And the reason why it's so unrepresentative is because there are so many voters that don't turn up for a primary election. And that's why you can't draw a real, real big conclusion from these primaries. So why are we even talking about it? I don't know. It's just interesting. We try to see what little bits and pieces we can snag from here and there, from this exit poll, from that exit poll, and say, this looks interesting. I'll keep an eye on this. Let's see if we see it in any other circumstances, which is what's going to happen in the Democratic Michigan primary tonight. So there has been a big push in Michigan, which has a significant Arab population. About 1.5% of the state is Arab. And there's been a big push by activist groups to urge voters to vote for the word uncommitted on the ballot in Michigan tonight for the primary, to vote against Joe Biden, to instead vote for uncommitted. Now, there's some, you know, nuance with this, is that in some states on the ballot, if you really don't want to vote for a lot of the candidates, you don't like any of your options, you can vote for uncommitted. It's similar in Nevada. There is an option on the ballot where you can bubble in the square that says none of these candidates. And a funny thing was that in the Nevada primary, because there's a caucus and a primary. The caucus is what Trump participated in, which actually allocated the delegates, and the primary is what Nikki Haley participated in because she didn't want to do the caucus. This cycle, and none of these candidates beat Nikki Haley. So more people went to the polls and voted for none of these candidates than more people voted for Nikki Haley, which I think is very funny. But in the primaries and in the general, you can vote for none of these candidates as an option. You can vote as none of these candidates as an option for the primary. And so it's a very similar thing in Michigan. You can vote for uncommitted because you feel as though you're not sure who you want to vote for, and you're not sure, you know, if you like any of the candidates. And the reason why this has been organized is because of Biden's handling of the Israel-Hamas war, more so about the humanitarian situation in Gaza, holding him responsible for that. Which I think is absurd in the first place, because all of his budgets have included humanitarian aid for Gaza. That he, of course, does not is very upset at the situation, as is everyone, that the innocent civilians in Gaza should not be in the situation that they are. Unfortunately, it is Hamas that's put them in that situation, and this uncommitted vote is for ceasefire. It's basically an uncommitted vote to urge the president to call for a ceasefire. And I think the biggest problem with this is that a ceasefire has to be two-sided, and there have been three, if not four, offers made by the Israeli government to Hamas and say, let's have a ceasefire, let's for a couple months, and you know, hopefully it'll continue, trade hostages. And consistently Hamas has said no, and unfortunately the Palestinians are at the whim of Hamas. And it's awful. It's devastating. And a ceasefire can't be one-sided. Otherwise, it's not a ceasefire. So it's a very, very difficult position that Biden is in. And so because of this, activists, some of whom organized for Bush in 2004, which is interesting, said that they are supporting an uncommitted, make sure to vote uncommitted on the ballot. Now, there is a benchmark by which we can measure this primary in terms of how uncommitted is going to perform versus Joe Biden. And that's from 2012, when we had the last Democratic incumbent president. In 2012, Obama was, the Michigan primaries were held, and uncommitted received 10.7% of the vote, of the total vote, which is actually a pretty significant number. There really wasn't much of a turnout for this primary. It was around 200,000 people, but that's a big deal. And according to the turnout data so far, like 500,000 Democrats have voted already in this election, in this primary. So it's going to be very, very hotly contested. It's going to be very, it seems to be higher turnout than it was in 2012. And I wonder if that turnout is being driven by a urge to vote uncommitted, or if it's driven by an urge to vote for Biden because of the uncommitted. Really don't know. But again, independents in this case, if it was an open primary, it would be probably more likely to, if they're independents, but they really affiliate with the Democratic Party realistically and they consistently vote for the Democratic Party, those voters would be more likely to support Biden. But because it's just a Democratic base of people who would never, ever have considered ever registering as anything else, it's very possible that you could have Biden performing worse and uncommitted performing better because of this. Now, no matter what happens, Biden will likely, regardless of what happens, no one's going to talk about Trump because the media, for some reason, likes to talk about Trump's strengths, and they like to talk about Biden being weak and bungling every situation and the like. But they don't talk about the dictatorship that Trump wants to usher into this country and make it Russia style. So I have a feeling no matter what the narrative is, the Biden campaign will be working hard to make sure that the media tells the story they want to tell. Tell the factual story, and the media will say, oh, he only wins 85% of the Michigan primary vote. Meanwhile, you have Trump winning 75%, but the focus is on Biden winning 85% of the vote. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but that is what they like here. That is what media likes. Media wants Trump to get reelected because then it helps pad their expense accounts. So there have been groups that have called for about benchmarks of 10 to 20,000 of uncommitted voters. And if they receive that many voters uncommitted, that they'll, declare victory. They're setting that because that benchmark is super low, because that's what they got in. They got around 10,000, I believe around 10,000, 20,000 votes in Michigan in 2012. So it's really easy to surpass it when the voting population has increased since 2012. But other than, progressive organizations, Representative Rashida Tlaib has urged voting uncommitted. Beto O'Rourke is, at large Texas man, doesn't hold any political sway over anything, but he's just bouncing around doing his thing, and he supports uncommitted. And a host of Michigan state representatives who are Democrats, about five or six of them say that will be voting uncommitted. So, again, does this really matter for November? I think it does in a way that is regardless of, unless uncommitted gets some crazy amount of the primary vote, I think it really doesn't matter at the end of the day, because the Arab populations in Michigan that are unlikely to support Biden in the primary are very unlikely to support him in the general regardless. I mean, these are areas that unfortunately went for Biden by about 60, 70 points in 2020. They went for Whitmer by about 50 points in 2022. These are right shifting areas. These are areas that are shifting more towards Trump. This was an accelerant. I mean, you know, Trump said that he would sort of raise the Gaza Strip, so it doesn't make any sense to me why you know, Arab populations would want to support that. But nonetheless, it's some form of political ploy. So in terms of how this matters for a, you know, general election, it's not, I guess, ideal for unity in the party moving forward. But also, a primary is not really indicative of a general election, for about the third time that I've said that on the air today. So I think that it'll be interesting and unique to see what precincts, what regions are going to be super strong voting for uncommitted. They're going to largely be in the Detroit area, and they're going to be largely around college campuses. And I'm curious to see just how strong this manifests, or if it really just is a media narrative that is being pushed to see how much engagement they can get, and to see what they are, the Biden team is working with, and what the progressive opposition is working with. In terms of 2020 general election support, 2024 general election support, and what areas Biden's really going to need to shore up. I mean, these aren't surprising if they're going to be, college students and minorities in the Detroit area. Those are areas that, of course, Biden understands that he has to emphasize. But it's going to be interesting just how strong and which regions will be the most targeted in terms of their support for uncommitted. So I'm really interested to see what that will be like, and it'll definitely be up for discussion next week. The last thing that I'm going to touch on today is the recent New York redistricting update. So New York in 2022 had a major red wave, cost Democrats the House, largely at the top of the ticket due to the governor not campaigning and the Republican being a very effective campaign with a message that just hit that year. And so Republicans are holding seats in double-digit Biden districts. But the court-appointed Republican-drawn map for the 2020 decade was overruled by the new Court of Appeals with a new Democratic appointee. And now Democrats are planning on redrawing the map, and they've rejected the new Independent Redistricting Commission map. Basically, what that is all to say is that New York is getting new maps, and those maps are going to be somewhat more favorable to Democrats. Whether they're going to be very favorable or somewhat favorable is not clear. But the maps that are currently in place that are sort of, they're not Republican-leaning, but they're relatively competitive in a state that has a Democratic trifecta, Democrats want to make sure that they can win more seats and shore up their majority or win back their majority. And so still waiting on any maps to see what the breakdown is going to be, still waiting on any reporting for that, which I'm checking my phone constantly to do so. And the assembly, from what I understand, the assembly and the Senate are going different routes. So the assembly is doing a little bit more of a modest sort of just shoring up Democratic incumbents, making some other Republican incumbents a little bit weaker, whereas the Senate is more likely to go on a full gerrymander path to really make sure that Democrats are secured to take back the House in 2024. I think that in my mind, I would prefer Senate Democrats' plan, because in 2019, the Supreme Court ruled in Rucho v. Common Cause in a 5-4 ruling, which John Roberts sided with the conservative majority, saying that partisan gerrymandering is okay as long as the High Court approves it. It's unclear whether or not this High Court is going to approve it, but now it has a new majority that is more inclined to support it. And because of that, Republicans have done so in states like North Carolina, Kentucky, Louisiana, Alabama, various states, Utah. And so why should Democrats, when they have the power, not do what would be the same thing that Republicans would do on their side? Especially North Carolina went from a 7-7 Democratic, 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans in a map in a pretty competitive state, to a 10-3 map, where there's 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats, most likely, and one competitive seat. So we're going to see how these maps shake out, but and we're not really sure sort of where exactly they're going to go, but it's going to probably define much of the House races. If these maps are more partisan gerrymander, then Democrats are going to very likely secure the House in 2024. If they're a bit softer, the House is going to be closer to a toss-up. Maybe it'll tilt towards the Democrats because of some other favorable map rulings. But this is definitely a big deal for redistricting, for redrawing, and definitely will also be something that we're going to be talking about on the next show. And the next show will be, I believe, on Super Tuesday, where a lot of those competitive Senate primaries that I was talking about last week are going to come up once again. That's all I've got on my schedule for today. I think that if you're sort of interested in hearing more about my my political takes, I haven't posted in a little bit, but check out my blog, swingpolitics.com. I post some, you know, some of my own insight, pulling from other people's data, stuff like that. Other articles that I think are interesting and sort of inputting that analysis into mine. So if you have a chance, please go check it out. And yeah, I hope everyone has a great rest of your week and an awesome rest of the day. This is Mitch with Swing Politics, and you're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Thanks, everyone.
You're listening to TK on 91.5 FM, WMFO.